Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
And so in the writing of it, there was a bit of resolution missing. And there's a moment in the fictitious fist fight between the brothers, because we never had a fist fight, but when Big Angel confronts Little Angel for keeping his distance, and Little Angel confesses. And that was the most agonizing part of the book for me. And I actually had to dictate it because I couldn't see to type. I was crying too much. And that was, of all the things in the book and all the things that could move one, you know, to a kind of sense of relief, that was it. The thing that I needed to say to him, and I didn't know was something that needed to be said, because I didn't know it was true. And so to be able to say that to him, even in writing, and somehow believing that he was hearing it anyway, that was the thing.
Morning coffee with Pandal, say, all my women around me. A good job, a garden full of chilies and tomatoes. The poetic words of Mexican-American writer, poet and teacher Luis Alberto Urrea from his latest book, The House of Broken Angels, published by Little Brown. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. How do our families shape our lives? And is it possible to live without regret? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack those questions with writer, poet and teacher Luis Alberto Urrea, whose new book, The House of Broken Angels, has just been published by Little Brown, where Luis writes, he couldn't find his brother or his mother's ghost in the crowd, so he watched his little brother. He couldn't take his eyes off him. Poor little angel, he thought. He had no idea what life was going to do to him. He wouldn't find it in books. So what do we learn from our parents, our brothers and sisters, and why are they so important?
Hi, I'm Luis Alberto Urrea, and I've been fortunate enough to publish books in all the genres at this point. So I've been on a mad tour. It was my ninth week of being on the road on this book. The new book is called The House of Broken Angels. It's a novel. It's my 17th book. And it comes out, or came out from Little Brown Publishers in New York City.
Really well done on the book, Luis. I have to say it's an incredibly warm read, to put it succinctly. It's philosophical, it's very engaging, and you bring up so many questions about family life, identity, and how we understand the mistakes that we've made. And it's a very interesting reflection on life. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off, and sure, we can take it from there. What does a good life look like? And does it all come down to maybe family and relationships?
Oh, that's a great question. I think it indeed comes down to family, to grace, you know. And one of the interesting things here in this country, as I'm sure you've all watched, is the bitter tone that has taken over the political discourse and the ethnic discourse in this country. And I was born in Mexico, but my mother was American. Interesting to you, perhaps, and your listeners, that my Mexican family is half Irish. My grandmother's name was Guadalupe Murray, and she was a red-haired, blue-eyed lass, just happened to be Mexican. So it was interesting to me to watch, knowing the history of how Irish immigrants were treated trying to establish themselves here, than to watch it repeated in my sort of genetic life with the response to Mexican immigrants here. And I think the desire in writing a book like this would be to make everyone saintly, you know, so people could see the wonderfulness of everyone in the story and be moved to kind of open-heartedness toward them. And I thought, well, wait, the reality is families are complex. And what if one stood up boldly in the face of censure from the president, at the very least, and said, no, this is a family, warts and all, and still a family full of grace and joy and beauty and all of those things all at once. So I wanted to do it that way. I wanted to write, you know, the epic, the immigrant epic, but for Mexican families, which I hadn't yet seen. And that's what I tried to do.
In your author's notes at the end of the book, you mentioned the late American writer and poet and essayist Jim Harrison. And you met him just before he died. I think he was a mentor to you at one stage, and you collaborated on lots of different ideas. And he said to you that, you know, sometimes God hands you a novel and you better write it. You had been talking yes. about your brother. And you based some aspects of the book on your brother. Is that right?
Yes, it's absolutely right. Jim himself was dying. My brother had just died. He, you know, the basis of this party, which over on this end of the world we jokingly have been calling the Mexican Finnegan's Wake, you know, was that my brother was facing his last birthday on Earth. He was turning 74 years old. And he was dying of cancer, and he was a great personality, a very strong, perhaps egotistical man. I don't think he'd mind me saying that. And his grandkids wanted to give him a farewell birthday party. And when he got aware of this, he embraced it wholeheartedly because he thought, well, yeah, I can attend my own wake while I'm still alive, you know, and I can sort of dictate the parameters of the worship. I can receive all the praise in the world. And that's what he did. And after he passed, I did an event with Jim Harrison. And interestingly, Harrison himself was quite ill and clearly was going to die. And he died not long after we did this event. And there was a thing he said to me that actually I put in the novel. When he came in after the event, they threw a banquet for him. And if you know much about Jim Harrison, he was a tremendous bon vivant. He was a serious eater, a serious drinker. And I think he had decided to go out as he had lived, you know. And so they were throwing him a gourmet supper. And one of the things that impressed me, he was suffering physically quite a bit, but he came in and he sat down next to me, which I was moved by. It was a long banquet table. And I said, are you all right, Jim? And he said, I will never be all right again, which I put in my novel. It was haunting. But, you know, one of the amusing things about it, it wasn't tragic in any way, was he had clearly decided to enjoy every kind of liquor he could possibly enjoy. And so when he sat down, he had a big glass of beer. And I was watching him thinking, oh, the master drinks beer. But when that was done, he ordered a glass of wine. I believe it was red wine. And then he had a glass of white wine. And then he had a glass, a shot of some clear liquor. It may have been vodka, it may have been tequila, gin, I don't know. And then he was having some whiskey. And I thought, wow, this guy, he's incredible. But during that meal and those drinks, he asked me to tell him about my brother's death. So I started to tell him the story, and he sat looking up at the ceiling. He tuned everybody out and just listened about my brother passing. And when I finished, that's when he said, sometimes God hands you a novel, you'd better write it.
Has writing the book made you look differently about the nature of time, do you think, Luis? In terms of what we're doing, what we're all doing with our time, and maybe the legacy that we're throwing out to the world?
Yeah, I think it gave me a different perspective on so many things. You know, but certainly time, or certainly the parameters of of grace, you know, and the understanding that we fritter away so much of our lives and we're not paying attention enough, you know, to what happens. We're not marking enough the moments that flit away. And I so was moved by a sense of even the afterlife dealing with this book, because, you know, sometimes it was as though he were here with me. You know, writing fiction based on your big brother is an interesting experience, but one, he was rather a mystic in his own way, and I felt him here. And there were scenes, actually, that I wrote in the book that when I'd run them by one of my nieces, who sometimes, she was his caregiver, so I would ask her about things as I was working on it, and she would say, "How do you know that?" Because my brother's widow had been revealing to her their private bedtime talks, and those ended up in the book in some way I don't understand. So time expanded a bit for me. I thought it would contract because I was thinking about mortality so much, but, you know, it began to take on a different, it became a little less dreadful to me in a funny way, even though I'm very aware of the clock running for all of us. It felt more expansive, almost like a Van Morrison album, you know, where you have all this into the mystic going on in your life, around your life. You don't notice it. And my rule has always been, certainly to my writing students, to pay attention. Pay attention. Your life is dictated. There's only so much you're going to have, but it's up to you to expand it infinitely within the boundaries of how long you'll be here. It's what you do with those moments. So in those ways, yes.
Big Angel writes a series of notes to himself. They're very philosophical, very poetic. Some of them are very warm, but he's celebrating his life all the way through. And it could be just looking at his children. It could be what he's eating, the sounds in the house, whatever it is, his chilies and tomatoes. He's savoring. It's lovely. Was that difficult to write, was it?
You know, it's funny because that was an odd thing that started appearing later in writing the book. I always have a notebook with me. Ever since high school, I guess, I've had notebooks with me. And, you know, they've gotten less elaborate and they've gotten more zen-like in some ways. And I have a friend who became disabled and quite ill. And he had always written, and he'd been a very robust man. And actually a physical therapist. So he had done body work with people for years, and then his body failed him. And he could no longer write because he didn't have the stamina and he didn't have the strength. But he realized he could write three words at a time. And so he created this genre of his own, which he called three-word mercies, which were like little almost haikus, you know, and they were three words that he always intended to lift him or to give him a more positive trajectory. So it would be three words like snow, then flowers. And because he couldn't move anymore, he'd say things like mountains, climb, me. Really lovely stuff. And so I was thinking about all that, and I'm greatly inspired by the haiku masters. I've read a lot of them over the years. So all of a sudden, this notion of writing gratitudes hit me. And there's a funny, you know, there's a Jesuit priest in the book. And when you read St. Ignatius, he starts coming across like some kind of Buddhist. You know, he comes across like a haiku master in so many ways. So those things just all came together in my mind. And I tried it. And it also gave me a compositional parallel because Little Angel, the younger brother, is there for all these events, but the family has become so overwhelming in his absence that he himself is keeping a notebook, just trying to figure out who is who and how they're related and who says what. And so it was interesting to me to have these two brothers doing a kind of implied duet without knowing it in their notebooks. But once that happened, once those lists started coming, I found it weirdly touching. I don't know. It felt like it opened a pathway for Big Angel that was beyond my narrative.
Well, it certainly offers a beautiful intimacy within the read and brings you closer to Big Angel, doesn't it?
I think it does. I don't know that you can get closer to him. One of the reviews here said that it was almost unbearably intimate, this book, which made me happy because I wanted it to be as close as you can possibly get to people, particularly in a culture here in the United States that is trying to separate itself from people in a predatory way, it seems to me. The soul, the little peeks into his soul. And I thought it was a little mysterious, too. And it was nice to have him be able to kind of make a commentary on what's happening within the text and outside of the text.
There is a lot of shame and regret running through the House of Broken Angels, both Big Angel in terms of some of his memories and the traumas he experienced when he was starting out in life, and then in his relationship with Little Angel, his brother, and overall within the family and the different dynamics that are going on. And it got me thinking, Luis, do you think you can live well and motor through life and enjoy life with some serious regrets? Like, do you think that's possible?
Don't we all? I think we do, don't we? It's just part of our journey, I think, through these years. And I think it's what we do with those. How do we handle those, right? How do we find the joy in the day, the grace in the hour? How do we find resolution? How do we find redemption? I think we all struggle with that. I think it's in all the great songs, you know. I think it's in all the great books, all the great poems. It's in the great symphonies. It's in the movies I love. There's an element of that, unless we are not honest in our existence. And, you know, if you can be a good man after having done bad things, which one would hope, right? You can be a good mother, a good daughter, a good brother, a good father, a good friend. You can fail and perhaps find redemption, even in the smallest way. One of my journeys in life of my own was I used to work with the crushingly poor in Mexico, in the north of Mexico, along the border. And I worked with a population of people who had to pick trash to stay alive. And, you know, that really was transformative. And the one of the men there said to me, you know, we're always looking for angels, aren't we? We look for angels all the time, but we look in the wrong place. We look on mountain peaks. We expect a great angel to be on top of a mountain, beaming light. The reality is most of us live down here in the valley. We live in the mud. That's where the angels are. Remember that. Angels are down here muddy, dirty, with the rest of us. You know, they take part in our life with us. And I thought that was metaphorically brilliant. You know, the grace. We don't have to look up at a mountain peak. It's down here. It's in rock and roll. It's in making breakfast. It's in going to work when you don't want to. It's in, you know, even in your sorrow, I think it's there.
One of the aspects of the book that I found very beautiful is your take on love, and within all its problems and its faults in relationships, that it's the very simple stuff that can be the so liberating and the so refreshing. Was that important for you to bring out?
Yeah. Love, it's all. It's everything, isn't it? Not to be, like a greeting card, but real love. I have all these rules I give my writing students, and one of them is, and this may be, you know, me exercising my Bono complex. I don't know, but I tell the students, fill your pen with love or don't bother picking it up. And it's interesting because women writers understand what I'm saying. Often it's it's the tough guys, the manly men who start to argue with me about this, and I say, what about pain? What about suffering? What about war? I say, yes, that's all true. But I'm not talking about, squishy, lovey-lovey love with little kitties with big blinky eyes. I'm talking about the hard work of love, love being an action more than a feeling. Love, love is tough. Any parent knows, any old person knows, any lonely person knows. Love can be a very hard burden. So the slightest, I think, touch of it, if acknowledged, is transformative. So it's important to me in this book, again, in people that are being disparaged publicly and attacked and dragged out of the country at night and so forth, I thought it was a bit revolutionary to show their love in the face of any kind of complication. And, and I thought, if I can make people who are holding up signs or insulting people or even threatening people for just a moment forget themselves and love these people, it would be a kind of a revolutionary act in itself.
Big Angel is very much a hero to all his family and his social networks. He seems to have a very good way with people, and especially women, whether it's his sisters-in-laws, his daughter, and also his wife, in terms of clearly he's in a very bad state, yet he still manages to make her feel wanted and make her feel like a woman. I thought that was very interesting.
Well, that's all because of my brother. The Urea men have an unbelievable amount of charm. I grew up watching these guys. They could romance a statue and make it blush if they wanted to. And my brother Juan was a dashing character in his own way. He was a little darker in some ways than the rest of the family. I think he was probably troubled by things in the past. Nothing like what's in the novel. That's all invented. But we all had especially them, my half-siblings, had a tough upbringing. He was a lover in his own way. And what I found remarkable about him was that he was so completely mad for his wife. Even at the end, he was just... He acted like the entire world could die and go away as long as his wife was there. And he kept up that passion to the last moment.
Thank you.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with Mexican-American writer, poet and teacher Luis Alberto Urrea about his latest book, The House of Broken Angels, which has just been published by Little Brown. I asked Luis how would he describe the US-Mexican relationship and whether he set out to write a novel that packed a hefty political punch.
Yes, I did. Of course. It's never been easy on some level. I think we've had a very long history of harshness toward immigrants and, you know, Latino immigrants, Mexican immigrants. You know, I look like I could be living in Dublin, with blue eyes, you know, perfectly American-looking fella. But when I came to the United States as a little boy, I had a Mexican accent. And that led to the kind of scenes you see in the book. And I remember in fifth grade in primary school was the first time we had left a kind of a Mexican community, a barrio, and moved into a generally Anglo neighborhood, which made my mother very happy because she was American and she wanted to be amongst her own. But when we got there, I was suddenly being called names that I'd never heard before. I was called a greaser, a wetback. They have a term they use in California, which is taco bender, because tacos have a little bend in the tortilla to hold the food. I was flabbergasted. And I thought Mexico was wonderful. Everybody I loved, everybody I revered up until that year, they were Mexican because that's who I knew, or Mexican-Americans. And they were magical, beautiful people. My grandmother, my godmother, my godfather, my half-brothers, my cousins, my aunts. And suddenly we're up in this neighborhood, and they were trash, and Mexico was trash, and Mexico was a site of filth and depravity suddenly, and drug addiction and prostitution, and it went so far that people believed Mexicans smoked cigarettes made of horse dung. I was lost, honestly. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to negotiate this, and I think it was a survival tactic. I don't even know that it was conscious, but I suddenly lost my father's accent and started speaking like my mother. I looked like my mother, but I was going to speak like her as well. And it took until going to college really to know that I was actually a complex being and not kind of trying to portray this role. You know, I got to college and suddenly there were these Spanish-named writers I'd never heard of because we weren't educated to know that there were Nerudas or García Márquez or Borges or Juan Rulfo or whatever. And then there was music and there was poetry and, you know, Lorca. That was a wonderful thing for me. So those internal experiences, which are fairly mild, still stick with me. And I watched my father struggled with it, and I watched my brothers and sisters struggle with it and adjust in various ways. And so, as I mentioned earlier in our talk, the history of our nation's response to immigrants has always been aggressive and paranoid and toxic. And I was thinking of all these things, and, you know, we're trying to have the American Brexit over here, you know, and for better or for worse, it has led to a lot of really heated, nasty rhetoric. And I spend a lot of my year every year talking to kids. And, you know, there are these kids, these Mexican kids, undergoing much worse than I underwent. They're in fear. They're ashamed. And people do stop them on the street and tell them, you're going to get thrown out of this country. People insult them for speaking Spanish. They don't want to speak Spanish anymore. And I think it's too bad because, you know, it expands you as in your soul and your mind to be able to negotiate two cultures, I think. I did. You know, Benjamin Franklin said very similar things about German and Dutch immigrants to what they're saying about Mexicans now. And the United States certainly wasn't welcoming to Italian people, you know, was very hard on Irish people, was hard on Asian people. You know, it's just a weird pattern. And I tell these kids, don't fear. It will change. You have to survive this. This, we are the phase right now. But sooner or later, that weird black beam of the negative lighthouse will circulate and find another person. And I, you know, the kids like to laugh. They like to have a good time. So I try to make it jocular with them. If you can speak about pain with joy, I think it's kind of intoxicating. And I tell them, look, you know, sooner or later, there's going to be a new populist president who doesn't like Norwegians, and they're going to forget about you. And they're going to begin saying, stop those Vikings. Let's build a wall on the East Coast and keep those Vikings out. And it'll be a different era for you. It just, you know, you start out being Mexican, and then you're Mexican-American, and you're American-Mexican, and then you're an American. It seems to be the kind of ritual hazing that seems to happen to people.
But it is amazing to think that here we are in 2018 and we're still crudely and simplistically looking at life and the other in life on race grounds. It is so shocking, isn't it?
Well, it's heartbreaking. It really is, because if you just take one moment, and I think that's the danger of art. You look at the other and realize the other is you. You know, dictators take out poets, folk singers, authors right away when there's a coup. It's because we're dangerous, because we're always talking about being human. And, you know, I'm often asked by interviewers, why are your novels so funny when they're about painful things? And I always tell them, you know, it's how can you hate someone you've laughed with? How can you disparage someone you've sat at a table with and laughed? You know, one of the other writing rules to my kids or my students, I always tell them, laughter is a virus that infects you with humanity. You share that laughter with somebody. Also, as a composer, you know, the funny moments soften the reader, and then you drop them into the canyon where they feel the pain that's coming. And those things are all subversive, and they should be subversive. I think art needs to be subversive. If it's not, it's just propaganda. It's greeting cards. But it should always, I think, tend or try to subvert assumptions and show us a different angle. And that angle is the most ancient one. I am you and you are me.
There's a very funny story towards the end of the book when Big Angel remembers when his mother tried to smuggle a parrot down at the bottom of her top, to put it politely. And it makes for hilarious reading. And then you go on to write, the border in those days is very different. No huge wall, no drones, no infrared tower. When you think about the border now, you have published several books looking at migrants coming through and the challenges they face. It's hard to even almost conceive what's going on at the moment. Yet so many people are turning their backs and choosing to ignore some of the challenges, the human rights challenges on the border there, aren't they?
Well, yeah, they are. And, you know, the new boondoggle in the United States is this massive, super expensive wall they believe they can build, which is absurd. I mean, if you just imagine 2,000 miles of desert and mountain range, you know, there's no way to put wall across that, nor why would you want to? One of the recent revelations here in the constant political chatter, that's all we do now, is we all watch political mania all day long. I think it's detrimental to us. But you know, the last person that really, really pushed a metal wall all around the border was a Ku Klux Klan member. A Klansman who was a governor, you know, and I don't quite understand it. But one of the reasons I write about these things is it's just obvious all over the world. You know, to me, it's a fantastic metaphor. It's something one can automatically see and understand. A big, ugly wall with trucks and dogs and helicopters and guns, keeping indigenous people out of land, refusing refugees seeking solace and safety. And so to me, it's this metaphor for our borders between all of us. Most of our borders are unseen, you know, but if you live on stage, as I seem to be doing lately, the last few years, and you have these audiences in front of you, you can see the border. There are fences everywhere, and they keep us from each other. Whether it's, you know, faith or color, gender, politics, we have any number of things that we can erect walls about, and I think we do. And I just think, you know, as a writer, my job is to kind of write love notes and toss them over the wall. That's what I'm trying to do. And it feels good to do that. And it feels healing. Healing to me, because that hurts. It makes me sad. It makes me angry.
You also touch on the separation barriers, I suppose, within the family unit. And little Angel, who is Big Angel's younger brother, they have different mothers, is very separated from his family. He lives in a different state. He educates himself, and he only turns up to family events on the, you know, the births, weddings and marriages type basis. And he's
right.
Seen as, you're right, he's seen that he's cheating the system in some way, a culture thief, a fake Mexican, more gringo than anything. And his sisters call him a gringo Mex, and he's seen as too much of Americano. I suppose you could throw that charge in some ways to a lot of different families, whether it's some siblings are moving up the property ladder, the class ladder, the professional ladder, whatever it is. It creates an uncomfortableness when some people are just getting on with their own lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a universal family problem, honestly. You know, I had a writer friend who is from your part of the world, and we were talking about people having success, and he said, you know, the reality is you think everybody celebrates you when, you know, you're doing well, and the rest of us are thinking, I'm going to get that bastard. And that was a real revelation to me. I thought, oh, my, that's true, isn't it? People, you know, because you seem uppity, you seem highfalutin, you think you're better than we are. And we hear, I don't know if you use this metaphor in Ireland, but here they often talk about the crab bucket syndrome, you know, where you can throw crabs in a bucket and they'll never escape because the other crabs pull them down as soon as they start to climb. And I think that can happen. And I think that, unfortunately, sometimes people who do get nicer houses or better cars or a college degree start looking down on the others. And if they don't, it feels like it. So yeah, I thought that was certainly a feature of a mixed Mexican American family, but I think it's a feature of any kind of family. You know, I think about Jack Kerouac. They thought he was crazy. They were mill workers, his family, and he, you know, started to become this mad poet, and they didn't particularly like it. I think that's a lot of truth in it. The Gringo Mex came from my big sister. I have two sisters. One of them has a meaner tongue than the other, and she had called me a Gringo Mex because I'm sure to them it was just that very thing, that our father was a you know, he was a bit of a playboy. And he had this big family, and then he left. And then suddenly he shows up with my mother, the first American in the family. And they certainly didn't appreciate that. And then I was born. And all they thought of me was, well, look at the little American kid. He has everything. You know, he has what we don't have. And so one can project those things into characters, and that ended up as a major part of the book. And it, in some ways, I think it's painfully true. I live far away from the family. I think we have a lot of love and a lot of closeness and a lot of hilarity, but for a long time there was a strangeness between us, partially due to my father himself, who wanted to keep the siblings apart because, like many playboys, I think he wanted his secrets kept, you know? And I didn't see my siblings, which was difficult for me because I thought, well, they just don't love me. I have all these big brothers and sisters, and I'm living in this ghetto isolation, and there's nobody here to hang out with. There's nobody here to protect me from the bullies, you know? So we each had our grievances from two sides of a border. And they came across the Mexican border one by one and settled in the United States. And they have huge families. And, you know, we have a very warm relationship. But I think it really blossomed after my father died. And Juan, the model for Big Angel, became the patriarch. And, you know, that's the dynamic in the book, that Big Angel is the patriarch. So even in his ruin, in his illness and pain, he's still king. And he's trying to make sure that his kingdom is sane and whole and will survive his passing, because he sees himself as the glue that holds it together. And his dream is to pull his little brother back into the family and have him run the family.
I'm just wondering, what does your broader family make of the book? Because I can imagine you write women beautifully, you write such strong characters, and you write their vulnerabilities so well. So I'm just wondering, what do your sisters, your aunts, and some of the women friends in your family, because I imagine you sprinkled flavours of them and tastes of them all across the book.
Oh, yes. Yeah, quite a bit. I mean, many of the characters are completely invented out of whole cloth. But certainly Big Angel and his wife, their daughter and their son, Lalo, those are all very, very close to living people. It was a little nerve-wracking, honestly. My brother's wife is named Blanca, not Perla. And she's never really learned English, which is interesting to me. You know, I always joke with her, well, you've only been in the United States 65 years. You're not in a hurry. You'll get around to it. But she prefers Spanish. I think she's embarrassed when she tries to speak English because it's accented, and she's been told that's terrible. But I was kind of keeping it quiet. But I was talking to my niece, who had been Juan's caregiver, or one of them, and had to deal with lots of awful things. She was the one at 2 in the morning who had to go and rush him to hospitals and things like that. And to my great chagrin, she told her mom, hey, guess what? Uncle Luis is writing a novel about all this. And so my wife and I went there to a little gathering, and we were all sitting at a table, some siblings and the widow and my nieces and nephews. And Blanca said, so do you have something to tell me? And I felt this bolt of panic. I said, what do you mean? She said, something you need to tell me? And I looked at my niece, who was grinning, and I said, did you tell her about this? And she said, yeah. So I said, okay, well, I'm writing a novel inspired by what happened here. And, you know, Blanca just kind of stared at me. So I found myself going into an impromptu writer's workshop, you know, saying, well, now, you understand that a novel is fake. It's It's a made-up story, but I thought Juan was so tremendous that I couldn't not write a fictional record of what happened. And fiction, even though it's fake, feels truer than nonfiction. And, you know, I was just talking fast, trying to save myself, all of them staring at me. And I said, so when one is writing a novel, it's like making a movie, right? I make a movie in my mind, and to make those characters real, you come in and play the character in my mind. And they, I think they were skeptical, but they started saying, oh, yeah, that's really interesting. And then when the book came out, like I mentioned earlier, they saw mystical things happening because so many of what were their secrets started appearing in other people's lives, and the dynamics, you know, which happened behind their closed doors that I wasn't there for very often, has started happening. And the family really embraced it. And because it became a success, I think they're very proud. You know, they're very happy. And on the tour, I went back home to San Diego. And it was quite an amazing event in that it was in a local bookstore, and it was jammed, more than 200 people jammed in the bookstore, which was kind of spectacular in its own way. People outside looking through the windows. And my family came, and they sat in the front row. They had put seats out and then people standing, and the family in the front row, including Blanca, who had never come to any of my events before. And they all sat there holding the book, just holding up the book. And when I got done, my nephew came up to me and he said this thing that in some ways is the great reward of all this. But he said, Deal, which means uncle. He said, Deal, you made thousands of Americans love my dad. And I thought, oh, wow, what a great thing. You know, that was the beautiful moment.
Last question for you, Luis. The House of Broken Angels is a very spiritual book. It's very poetic. It's very perceptive in parts. And you're throwing out a lot of questions to the world and to the reader. I'm just wondering, what were you able to let go of when you finished the book?
Oh, regret. Definitely regret. There were passages in the book which didn't reflect life. They were things I wish could have happened, but in some ways did. If that makes any sense. You know, the party really happened. You know, the death pretty much happened as I described it. But the key to the book is those moments when the brothers are lying in bed together. My brother asked me to get in bed with him, and I spent a lot of the day in bed with him on and off talking. And the other family members would come and crawl in bed. And we had these amazing dog piles of people, different generations. And you know, there was a moment when all of my siblings came in the room and we were all in and on the bed at once with him. And my wife took a picture and it turned out to be our last picture of all of us together ever taken. And it's a holy picture. And so in the writing of it, there was a bit of resolution missing. And there's a moment in the fictitious fist fight between the brothers, because we never had a fist fight, but when Big Angel confronts Little Angel for keeping his distance, and Little Angel confesses. And that was the most agonizing part of the book for me, and I actually had to dictate it because I couldn't see to type. I was crying too much, and that was, of all the things in the book and all the things that could move one, you know, to kind of sense of relief, that was it, the thing that I needed to say to him and I didn't know was something that needed to be said because I didn't know it was true. And so to be able to say that to him, even in writing, and somehow believing that he was hearing it anyway, that was the thing. And, you know, there was also great, let's face it, great relief that the family embraced it. And then this astonishment that the United States seems to be embracing it. That makes me really happy. And now I'm talking to you.
Mexican-American writer, poet and teacher Luis Alberto Urrea. The House of Broken Angels is published by Little Brown and retails for just under €18 in hardback. Now, I have to say hats off to Luis. This is a gorgeous read. It's emotional, it's intimate and incredibly funny. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say thank you for listening and a huge shout out to the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to close tonight's broadcast with a sentimental note from Big Angel, from Luis Alberto Urrea's The House of Broken Angels. Wildflowers after rain, the heart breaks open and little bright seeds fall out. Good night.
Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.